unfortunately, I'm the last talk of the day, and this is also a somewhat theoretical talk. So I'm hoping to keep you all awake. Please do ask me questions and stop me quite often, just because otherwise, well, it's going to get boring for me and for you. It has been a long day. Okay, so let me start by, well, saying how I was brought into what I'm going to talk about. So a lot of the talks that we've been hearing can be thought of as a discussion of the geometry of a set of points, sometimes in RD or in Hilbert space, which is a way of saying RD with D equals infinity, sometimes in another metric space. Now, a lot of results that talk about sets, results that describe the geometry of sets that lie in RD, have constants that depend exponentially on D. And this has a name, it's called the curse of dimensionality, and well, this has been mentioned several times. I'm going to talk about one place where that curse disappears, or you can make that curse disappear, and then somehow talk about similar type results in metric spaces. I'm going to mention a bunch of theorems by a bunch of people, and somehow they have a common thread, so in some sense they're different ways of saying the same thing in different scenarios. We'll get to that. So the basic question that I'm going to start by talking about is, you have some set, which we're going to call K, and it lies in RD. And the question is, when is this set contained inside one single connected set of finite length? And I think I have a picture. So this is what I think of when I think of a connected set. Okay, so something that could be very complicated, but has finite length.
You mean finite
one-dimensional Hausdorff measure, to be technical. Yes. But in practice, finite one-dimensional Hausdorff measure, when you look at anything that looks like this, it's length.
For purposes of a tutorial, it's length.
Yes. Yes. And so one question is, given some set K, I want to construct some finite length connected set, and I want to be able to estimate the length of this set. You could ask, what these estimates depend on? Do they depend on the number of points? Do they depend on the dimension? And well, the goal is going to be to say, no, they don't. And then, at the end, we're going to see how this connects to metric embeddings and the stuff that Yair was talking about, at least on some philosophical level, or somewhat practical level, depends where this goes. This was an example of a set. I want to also give an example of a more complicated set. So if you start with a square and then you delete everything in the square and keep these four pieces, and from each of these pieces you delete most of it and you're left with this, and you continue this process till infinity, then what you're left with is a very complicated set, it has a simple description, but it's complicated, at least in some sense. This is called the Garnett example, and this is another set that's useful to keep in mind, throughout this talk. I want to start out by talking about theorems that, Peter Jones proved part of them, and then Kato Kikyulu extended them. The intuitive picture that they're going to give is the following. So if you have some connected set that's in RD, and it has finite length, so think about that thing with the arms that I had, let me draw a picture of that. About something like this, that lies in RD. The intuitive picture is that this thing is flat on most scales and in most places. What I mean by this is, if I look at this and I choose a ball and I center it on the set, then if I look at what's inside this ball, the situation is usually that what's inside the ball is pretty flat. Okay, so here it's very flat, here it's not flat at all, here it's a little bit flat. We're going to quantify all of this. And in fact, it turns out that quantifying this in the correct way gives a good characterization for when you have a set that's a subset of a finite length set. I need some definitions, unfortunately. There aren't going to be that many. This is one of them. It's a very geometric definition in some sense. It's hiding behind notation, so please, if there's one definition that you should remember until the end of the talk, it's this one. So please ask to clarify if I'm not being clear enough. So this is the Jones beta number after Peter Jones. So you fix some set K. So in this case, in this picture at least, my set K is this thing with the arms. And I'm going to look either at a cube Q or a ball Q. I don't really care which. So I'm going to, in this picture, I have already drawn balls that I'm going to call Q. And I'm going to look at the best fitting line for this set. So what it means is I'm going to look for the best, well, I'm going to look for the thinnest cylinder that contains K intersect Q. So for this thing, the thinnest cylinder is going to be something like this. I hope everyone can see that. In this case, the thinnest cylinder is going to be pretty thick. It's going to look something like this. Okay, so what is beta with respect to K of the ball Q? It's the width of that thinnest cylinder divided by the diameter. So it's a number that's scale independent. What that means is that if I take this picture and I blow it up by 20, I get the same number. Right? It's a pure number between 0 and 1. Okay. Any questions so far? Okay, so the first theorem, so let's see what the theorem says, and then we'll try and say why it's surprising. So if you have a connected set that lies in the plane, and if you look at the following sum, so you're going to sum over a bunch of cubes, right? We're summing over Q in a dyadic grid. I'm going to say what that is in a second. And we're going to sum the dyadic, we're going to sum beta squared with respect to this connected set of 3 times each cube, and we weight things by the diameter of the cube to get a quantity which is bounded by the length. Let me explain what we're summing over. So the dyadic grid has many cubes in it. So it's all the cubes that you get if you chop the plane up into D's and then refine and refine and refine and do this in each place to all sizes. So you get infinitely fine and infinitely coarse. Okay, so this is a big sum. Even proving that this sum is finite is hard. And it turns out that if you take this sum, which by the way has correct units, because this has no units, it's scale independent, and here you add in length units, you get something that's bounded by the length. Okay, so you can ask yourself, or you can ask me, why do I care about this sum?
In 3Q, you're just inflating the...
Sorry?
3Q, you mean just inflating
the... Good point. So what is 3Q? So if you take... If you look at this cube... You look at this cube and call it 3Q is a cube of side length 3 times with the same center. Thank you. So these are overlapping cubes. So why do I care about the sum on the left-hand side? Well, it turns out that if you have any old set in the plane, not connected or anything, so just a collection of points, you're looking for a set which is connected and contains a set. So you can think of this as some collection of roads which allow you to travel between any 2 points in the set. Then you can find one. And the length of this connected set, so this set of roads, gamma 0, is bounded by, the diameter of the set that you had, plus this sum, which is exactly this sum, except you take it with respect to the original set K. Okay, so on one hand, this weighted sum is pretty large in the sense that given a set K, this weighted sum tells you how long your set of roads needs to be. On the other hand, it's not too big because it's bounded by the length of gamma. Okay, so I'll say more along that line in a second, but as I stated, these theorems hold for sets in the plane. Kato Kikuyu extended this a couple of years later to sets in all of RD in a very nice paper. And as a corollary of all these theorems together, you get that if you take any connected set in RD, its length is up to constants equivalent to this sum plus the diameter of the set. So it's length. So for this, for any purpose, anything I'm going to say, it's all the theorems are just as difficult if you assume that your set is composed of straight line segments, and you're really thinking about length.
Even the sum of the lengths.
The sum of the lengths of these intervals. So everything is just as difficult. So for any connected set, instead of measuring the length up to constants, you can just look at that sum. And more generally, if you have any ohm set K, then this weighted sum of the beta numbers is proportional to the length of the shortest curve that contains the set K. So this is called the analyst traveling salesman theorem. So it's a way of writing length as a sum in little L2. Questions so far? I don't care about that. And I don't want to talk about this slide except to say that there is a dictionary, which makes some people happy, that corresponds, so it takes beta numbers to wavelet coefficients. And I can talk to whoever wants to talk about that later. What are the issues with these theorems? So I wrote them in a small font up there. I hope everyone can see them. If you look at the way they're phrased right now, the constants that hide behind these twiddle signs, so this means smaller than constant times length, are constants that are exponential in dimension. Okay, so if you have things that are in R100, then you're unhappy. It's easy to come up with examples. You can do this just by taking a few points. It turns out that one can reformulate these theorems in a way which is independent of dimension. So how do you do this? Well, it turns out that the source of all evil is the fact that we summed over cubes in a dyadic grid. And the way to get rid of the dimension dependence is to switch to balls that don't lie in some arbitrary grid that doesn't have anything to do with the set, but balls that actually approximate the set in some manner. So let's formalize this. So we start with some set K, which we assume has diameter 1. And now, well, we look at a bunch of what's called nets for this K. So Xn is going to be an approximation of the set K up to 2 to the minus n. So, well, I think you've all seen related ideas to this. So it's fairly simple to come up with these nets. And for every point in a given net, you're going to look at, so if x lies in xn, so this is something that approximates the set up to 2 to the minus n, you're going to look at a large ball around it. How large? So a ball of radius a times 2 to the minus n around it. And going back to this picture, so if I fix one scale, say the scale of this ball, I'm going to have something that looks like this. So many, many overlapping balls at a given scale, and then have this picture essentially at all scales. So this is a replacement for the dyadic grid. And it turns out that you can write the following. So you can just rewrite theorem 1 and theorem 2, so theorem 1 prime and theorem 2 prime. And if you sum over this multi-scale version of the dyadic grid that has nothing to do with a grid, but everything to do with balls centered around your set, then nothing depends on dimension. What's the moral of the story so far? So the moral is it's useful to sometimes forget about the ambient space and focus on your set.
I think I lost here, I guess. I mean, so GK, you have every possible ball around every possible point of K.
Exactly.
And so if K has lots of points, this could...
Sorry, it's not every possible point of k. So at scale n, I look at balls that are 2 to the minus n separated. So I look, let me go back to the slide. So I look at xn, so that's a 2 to the minus n net for k.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so every 2 points are separated by 2 to the minus n. And then I look at large balls around them. So I have a lot of overlap, but I do have some control on the overlap.
So in a certain sense, at every scale, there's only one ball, where one is equal to...
Yes and no. So in a certain sense, there is only one ball, but this is a very dangerous statement to make. And the reason is that we're not bounding the dimension.
Right.
So a priori, you could have balls in all different directions if your set is complicated.
So you get to pick xn. I mean, the devil doesn't pick xn. You get to...
No, the devil can pick it. So even if the devil picks it, but obeys these laws, then I'm happy.
So the devil picks xn for each n.
Yes, so but xn has to contain xn minus 1, so I have to keep refining. But that's actually only necessary for half of the theorems. But that's getting technical. But yeah, the devil picks the nuts.
I'm sorry, does it have to be 2 to the minus n in both places, or can it be, for example, 2 to the minus n plus 1 on the second line?
That does not matter much.
It doesn't?
Well, so you have this a here. Right, so you're, in the end, you have a lot of overlap anyway.
Oh.
Sorry, well, yeah, so you could have a minus 1 here, and I'm still happy.
So
yes.
What determines the
constant? What determines these constants? The number A. That's it. You had a question?
Somehow, for me, the difference between a ball and a square is a little bit.
Okay, so what you're saying is, you know what? If the only difference is between balls and squares, then root D should fix all problems. And root D is maybe not so evil. It's not exponential in D. But there's a big difference between balls and squares, and that's that it took balls that are centered around points in the set. And if you just look at squares that come from this grid, then... So let me redraw a version of this picture just at one scale. And let's look at these 3 points. And we have 3 times Q, if you remember, in the original theorem. So each of these Qs, when you compute beta of Q, is going to see these 3 points. So it's going to have beta, which is larger than, say, 1/10. And how many cubes do you have? Well, in this picture, you have 8. But generally speaking, it's an exponential in dimension.
But you could replace the balls by cubes centered on your curve, right?
Yes, and then you only pay square root D. So this may be good in a practical sense, but the philosophy is that what you really care about is balls, and you want them to be centered on your set. So now you want the set to be your focus of attention. No more questions about this. So as before, you get the corollary that if you have some set that lies in RD or Hilbert space, you have that this weighted sum of beta numbers has size which is equivalent to the length of the shortest curve, which contains your set K, and nothing depends on dimension. So what usually happens when you see something like this, you say, well, okay, I can do this for RD, I can now do this for Hilbert space. What can I do for metric spaces? In other words, suppose I have a graph, okay, and I have a bunch of nodes on this graph, and I want to make a similar type statement. Can I make it or not? So around the same time where this happened, a bunch of other people care about this in a variety of metric spaces. And one basic concept that you want to start talking about is curvature. Let me draw some picture. have 3 points. I want to define what's called the Menger curvature of these 3 points. So if these 3 points are in Euclidean space, you have a circle that goes through them, and I apologize for the bad quality of the circle. And the circle has a center, and all of these arrows have the same length.
That's in some Hilbert space now.
This is in the plane. So this is a circle. In any case, so this is R and this is R, and the curvature of these 3 points, and the Menger curvature of these 3 points, let's call them x1, x2, and x3, is simply defined to be 1 over R. Now, you can actually define this for any 3 points in a metric space. Okay, so you take 3 points in a metric space, they have 3 distances between them. Well, you can find 3 points in the plane that have the same mutual distances just because the metric space satisfies the triangle inequality. And so you take 3 points in a metric space and you map them to the plane isometrically. You draw the circle and you talk about 1 over R as the Menger curvature of these 3 points in a metric space. So that's what I wrote here. Okay. Now, you can define the number beta of these. Actually, okay, so let's give things names for a second. So, A, B, C, and H. So assume for a second that these 3 points are up to constant the same distance from each other. So you could have this distance be 1 over 10 and this distance be 5 and so on, but you don't have triangles that are too squished together. So it turns out that A plus B minus C is the same as H squared divided by the diameter. By the diameter of these 3 points. Now, you should look at this, and more precisely, you should look at this quantity, and this should remind you of beta squared times diameter, right? So this is deviation from some reasonably fitting line, and earlier I divided by the diameter, and I squared it, and then I multiplied by the diameter. Here I'm squaring it and then dividing by the diameter, but it's the same thing. Okay, so you should think about this as philosophically, or not so philosophically, actually, technically as beta squared times diameter, where I look at a ball, well, let's say what I'm looking at. So this is beta squared of the triple x1, x2, x3. And I'm looking at a ball that's a ball around x1 of radius, say, diameter. Or diameter of just the diameter of these 3 points. Okay, so following this philosophy, Imo Halma, so he's someone from Finland, defined beta squared of q times diameter of q to be, so we looked at the supremum over, by the way, I didn't say one important thing, sorry. This is the same as 1 divided by r squared, where r is r. Okay, so you should look at this and say, do some trigonometry and decide that you're happy with this. So this is a simple exercise in trigonometry. In any case, if you look at this...
The units aren't quite right, so there's
a... very correct. Peter looks at this and says, well, here we have units of length, here we have units of length, here we have units of 1 over length squared, so something is bad. And the way to fix this is to multiply by diameter cubed, and then everyone should be happy. So if you look at the supremum of these 1 over r's squared, and you, as was mentioned, multiply by diameter cubed, then you get something that has units of length, and you can define beta squared using this. So beta, you just declare beta squared times diameter to be this quantity. Okay, and you have something that is a metric space version of the definition that we had earlier with thin tubes and so on. It turns out, as was shown by Imahoma, that that you can do half, at least, of what we had before. So he has a version of theorem two. So given a set K, earlier we had the existence of a connected set containing K. This is the same as parameterizing K. That's simple, but I don't want to talk about it right now. What he did was constructed a Lipschitz function from subset of 0, 1, which he called E, onto the set K, such that this Lipschitz norm, the Lipschitz norm of this function was bounded by this. And if you use the fancy word geodesic space and so on, you can just say this set is a subset. So you can say that K is a subset of a finite length set, and the length of the set is bounded by this quantity. Okay, so you have the exact same result as you had before, just in a metric space. So essentially you have theorem two for a metric space.
What's happening to connectedness? Where is the connectedness?
So you have a subset of 0, 1. You have a Lipschitz function from a subset of 0, 1. You can extend it to all of 0, 1 if your set was geodesic. If your space, that's what I'm trying to say, is geodesic.
And if not, you can add points to the space.
And if not, you can embed it in L infinity of the tenant. But it turns out, so this is really the same question, just phrased a bit differently. You look unhappy.
I'm digesting.
Okay. You can ask, when is theorem one true in this setting? So the way theorem one was just phrased, the answer is it's just not true. So the converse to the theorem I just had on the board is not true, and you can find an example, and the example lives in L1, but I actually don't want to draw this example. Just for completeness, there was another version of theorem two for the Heisenberg group, and also in that case, they don't know how to prove a theorem one. Meaning, you only have half of the theorem, so you can, given a set K, construct a connected set that contains it, and its length is bounded by this sum, but this sum could be huge. Okay, so you found the connected set containing your set, you parameterized it, but it could be way too long. So it became interesting to see in what categories can we actually go both ways. So we're looking for theorem twos that have corresponding theorem ones, or theorem ones that have corresponding theorem twos. So in order to do that, we have to go to the right setup. And to do that, we go slightly back in time, and we talk about a certain category of sets. Lars Allforce defined these sets for j equals 1. Guy David extended the definition for other j, and made very nice use of this. What is the definition? We call a set J Allforce David regular if, for any point in the set, and any ball around this point whose radius is bounded by its diameter, think about J equals 1 and replace this with the length of the set inside the ball is bounded above by some constant times the radius, and is bounded below by another constant times the radius. Okay, so these are sets that have up to constant linear growth. So think about anything I can draw like this, except I'm not allowed to go like this ever. And it's all allowed to be disconnected, but I can't have isolated islands like this. In this setting, you can replace talking about the thinnest tube containing your set with some average deviation statement. So this is sort of much more amenable to applications. So what do you do? Well, you can say, think about Q equals 2 here. You can look at the best fitting line. So here, again, J is 1, so J plane is line. So you can look at the best fitting line in an L2 sense. Okay, so the line that minimizes distances squared. can define beta that corresponds to this notion. So the average deviation, the average deviation squared, square rooted, divided by the length. Okay, so this is just, by the way, this is a quantity which is very simple to compute, right? And there's a theorem by the Levine sums, which I believe should be some model theorem for a lot of work. This theorem is a version of theorem 1 plus theorem 2 that we had before. So this theorem says, well, assume that you have a set which is regular, meaning it doesn't have very small isolated islands and it's not too dense at any point. First of all, there are a bunch of equivalent statements. So one is the statement that K is contained inside a connected 1L4th regular set. So it's contained inside a not so terrible curve. The other is, well, let me say these in words and then explain what these are in detail. So the other says that on average, beta is not too big. So this is a slightly technical way of saying this, but this essentially says, so this is a continuous version of the sum that we had earlier, but it essentially says that if you, at a given scale, start summing beta squared for all finer and finer scales, the sum is never too bad, meaning it's always controlled up to constant by the radius of the ball that you start with. I'm not going to talk about what it means to be good for all k-kernels, but it's actually pretty important for me to say what BPLI and BPDI mean. So these are acronyms for big pieces of Lipschitz images and big pieces of bi-Lipschitz images. Let's actually define this. So a set has big pieces of Lipschitz images for any x inside it and any radius which is bounded by its diameter, so any reasonable ball, you can take a chunk of the set which is relatively big in the sense that it's not arbitrarily small, so relatively big in a very weak sense, by the image of a Lipschitz function. Okay, so, what am I saying? I'm saying that at least 10%, say, of the set. So a set, okay, so for us, J is always equal to 1. So a set has big pieces of Lipschitz images with J equals 1 if, in any way, at least, say, 3% of my set is covered by the image of a line. Sorry, a Lipschitz image of a line. Okay, so that's what it means to have big pieces of Lipschitz images.
So could you just go back one slide, please? Because I just wanted to make a didactic point that whatever is going on here, of course, the natural Q here is 2. So,
yes.
And then what happens is this is just a fancy version of classical least squares statistics, as in statistics 101. But the difference is now being done multi-scale. So it's not just a global object. You're computing it at all points of the sets on basically dyadic scales. So first on scale 1, then a half, then a quarter. And so whatever is going on here, this is really some discussion of multi-scale least square statistics.
Yes, so thank you. Let me add, so I skipped a slide in between, and so I keep talking about least squares statistics when you try and approximate with a line, but, the slide I hit was one where you talk about this with J-planes, so where you talk about deviation from planes or hypersurfaces of high dimension. So we have, we know what big pieces of Lipschitz images are, and the same way you can define big pieces of bi-Lipschitz images. So you say that a set has big pieces of bi-Lipschitz images if, essentially for any reasonable ball, 3% of the set inside this ball is covered by the image of a bi-Lipschitz function. And having said that, let's go back to now look at the theorem. So the theorem says the theorem says that you're connected inside a nice set, if and only if you have some geometric condition about the multiscale version of these squares, and if and only if you have, well, at every scale and at every location, you have a very small percentage of yourself at least, but you know, something bounded below of a Lipschitz image, if and only if you're at that scale, you're a bi-Lipschitz image of say the unit interval or of a unit interval of the correct size. So sort of this is saying that so these are different ways of measuring how on all scales you can be nicely behaved. So this is the model theorem in Rn or Rd that one would like to carry over into metric spaces. So talking about metric embeddings, say, for 1 second, so in metric embeddings, you're trying to find a very big piece that is a bi-Lipschitz image of some simpler space, like Rn for some n. And this tells you, well, you can do this, and you can actually do this uniformly good at every point and every scale, if and only if you have some other geometric condition. And, well, so this is as stated for subsets of Rd, but it turns out that you can say something about metric spaces as well. So let's see what you can say. So can we push this into the metric space setting? Okay, so the same guy that showed the previous theorem I talked about constructing one-dimensional sets or one-dimensional functions in a metric space has a version for regular sets as well. Maybe instead of talking about the technicalities of what's written here, I should just say the following. So we have curvature here, and we're looking at some average of curvature. So what he's saying is the following. Assume that for any point and every radius around it, which is not too big, so for any ball, the average curvature is not too bad. Okay, so roughly speaking, this is a different but equivalent way to what we had before of saying the set is pretty flat on most scales and most locations. So if the average curvature is not too bad, then at every point and every scale, then there is a nice set, so nice meaning all fourths to be regular, which contains your original set K. So this is just a continuous version of, let's just go back, to that theorem over there and to the theorems that we had earlier on the board. Okay, a different way of saying this is what I call the Carlson condition implies big pieces of Lipschitz images. In particular, there's one Lipschitz image, but I don't want to say much about that. But in any case, the curvature integral is just really this integral, and you're saying that's not too large, and if that's not too large, then your set is a subset of a finite length set. And that also means that it has a big piece of a Lipschitz image. The nice thing about this theorem is that the converse is true. So earlier we had a theorem that says under some conditions we can construct a connected set that contains my original set. But I told you without showing you that the analog for theorem one is just false. In this setup it is true. Yes?
Technical question. So the theorem is stated for that the conclusion on the bottom, which is a weaker conclusion, holds for any.
That's very true. And actually, it's originally stated not for complete geodesic metric spaces in that language, and I was just trying to, so if you don't look at this, then the formulation is just simpler.
Sure.
But yes, absolutely. Okay. So it turns out that the converse to the previous theorem is true. So if you have a connected one-off of regular set, then the average curvature is small. And what this really gives is that if you have big pieces of Lipschitz images, then you have a Carlson condition. So if we go back to this slide, then we already have that a condition like this is close to a condition, or is equivalent to a condition like this, having good pieces of Lipschitz images. So again, this is for one-dimensional all first regular sets. So it turns out that more is true. So it turns out that if you have a one all first regular set, this is actually true for all J, then big pieces of Lipschitz images implies big pieces of bi-Lipschitz images. So if at all scales and all locations, you can find a piece which is which comes from a Lipschitz image of a Euclidean set, then you can actually replace the statement with a bi-Lipschitz function. So your set has finite distortion equivalents to the same dimension Euclidean set. And what you can get from this is that the theorem of David and Sims for dimension one, for one dimensional sets that live in some metric space, is actually a metric space statement. So you have some Carlson condition, and this is equivalent to having, the interesting equivalence, I guess, is this and this. So you have some Carlson condition, and that's equivalent to having, at all scales and in all locations, a finite distortion embedding to some RD. Sorry, to R1, actually. Finite distortion embedding to R1 of a big piece. And by big, I mean 3%. Change 3 to any number. The next step is to try and do this for larger J. So not just for one-dimensional sets. But I think I'm already testing the tolerance too much. So let me just say what questions are actually out there that I care about. So parts of what I told you about are true for J equals 1, and parts are true for other J. So meaning sometimes when you talk about a metric space, you know part of the results that I talked about for a metric space, where you have an analog of a plane and so on, but not all of them. So you want to sort of complete the picture and figure out how to do everything that David and Sims need to do in RD, but for a metric space. And the missing piece is, what is the Carlson condition? So what should be these beta numbers, but not for curves, but for hyperplanes and so on, sort of their metric space equivalents. And then one looks at this and says, well, all first David is too restrictive an assumption. So you want to relax that assumption and talk about doubling spaces or non-doubling spaces. And you want to say, well, suppose I have n points. What do I lose? So if I'm allowed to lose log n factors, and we still have the same theorems. And just in conclusion, so these questions are very related to all the computer science embeddability questions. And, because of the multi-scale nature of all of these theorems, they're also very amenable to application. And, it's late in the day, so thank you very much for your attention.